Midstream.
Iran urged Greece last week to cooperate in resolving the crisis of Iran seizing two Greek oil tankers without U.S. interference, which came in retaliation to Greece seizing an Iranian tanker off the shores of Greece. Tehran seized the two tankers on Friday after Athens seized the Iranian-flagged tanker Pegas in April. The United States, which imposes strict sanctions on Iran, demanded Greece to cease the shipment of Iranian oil, and Greece delivered. U.S. and Greek diplomats called on Iran to immediately release the two tankers, their cargoes, and crews. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the United States stood to support its NATO ally Greece in the face of this unjustified detention. I kid you not, he literally said that after his country had seized an Iranian oil tanker 2 months prior. Spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh did not let that just pass. Khatibzadeh suggested that Blinken should realize that the time when the United States unilaterally imposed its conditions over the world is over, calling Washington the biggest disruptor of free trade in the world. Khatibzadeh then accused the Greek government of taking orders from a third party, but then reiterated that the relations between Iran and Greece must remain based on good intentions. Naval commandos of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps decided to take action as diplomacy developed and seized two Greek oil tankers that were sailing Friday evening in the Persian Gulf waters near the Iranian coast. This retaliation reflects two main issues. The first, Iran sends a strong message to Greece, America, and the European Union countries that it will react in similarity and immediately to any aggression targeting its tankers in international waters, inside or outside its territories. Second issue is that the nuclear negotiations between Iran, the United States, and other European countries in Vienna are on the verge of collapse, and what remains is the official declaration of the failure of the talks. It is ironic that Greece, which was the initiator of the aggression and seized the Iranian tanker Pegas and 19 Russian sailors from its crew, described Iran's detention of its two tankers, which carry about 2 million barrels of oil, as an act of piracy and a violation of international law by Iran. However, Greece in international waters at American request and legal act, and it has nothing to do with piracy. Ladies and gents, behold the Western height of arrogance, lying, and hypocrisy that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has come to put an end to. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In a quick response to the United States' confiscation of a shipment of Iranian oil off the coast of Greece, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps seized two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. Tehran accuses Athens of helping the United States seize an Iranian oil tanker over alleged sanction violations in the Mediterranean. The raid marks the first major incident at sea in months as tensions remain high between Iran and the West over its shattered nuclear deal with world powers. To discuss this issue with us from Athens is Lamprini Thoma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thank you very much for being with us, Lamprini. It's always a pleasure. So, Lamprini, let us begin with what Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps did last week by seizing a Greek oil tanker in retaliation to what Athens did by assisting the United States of America to seize an Iranian oil tanker off the shore of Greece last April in the Mediterranean Sea. Now, Washington's pretext for this sort of piracy against Iran is allegedly that Iran had violated Washington's crushing sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Why did Greece choose to take a side in this dilemma, knowing that it might risk its own tankers that are passing through the Persian Gulf?
Oh, Greece, the current government acts more or less like a protectorate of the U.S. The current prime minister acts unilaterally many areas and often goes above and beyond our contractual obligations in EU and NATO, because we are members, unfortunately, or even whatever the US is asking. We lack an independent foreign policy. We don't even have a vigilant foreign ministry. The foreign minister is often second-guessed by the prime minister. In this instance, things are even more complicated because the government decided to stand against the most financial strong part of the Greek elite, the ship owners. Greek ship owners control 25% of shipping around the world, mm-hmm. about 15% of all cargo ships, meaning a net worth of over $50 billion. Especially in transporting LNG, they own the biggest fleet in the world, and they have 58% of shipping in their hands in the EU. Mm-hmm. So the government endangered their business worldwide and in the Persian Gulf, which also made their insurance costs go through the roof right now. Mm-hmm. The PM wasn't even concerned about that, because he had put, as they say, all his eggs in one basket. And he's either naive to believe that the US will support us if we face a warm episode with Turkey, or, as rumors have it, has a personal agenda and sees himself as the possible next Secretary General of NATO.
Well, that seems like a lot of interest there, or a conflict of interest, if I may. But in your article, you published an article on Saturday, June 4, where you say that Greek lawyers note that Greece's legal aid agreement with the U.S. Only applies to acts that both sides recognize as a crime. And since the EU and Greece do not consider the Iranian army as a terrorist entity the same way the US does, then the Greek court's decision is absurd to allow such piracy off the coast of Greece, meaning that the court order is actually illegal under international law. Do you think that the Greek government will be held accountable for allowing this act of aggression, or rather you think that a diplomatic solution might actually be attained afterwards?
We all hope, the common people, we all hope for a diplomatic solution. And I must say that most Greeks are ashamed for what happened. And this was the sense in social media, in the comments in the press. But with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sidestepped, who is going to work for a diplomatic solution? That's our main problem. Mm-hmm. And our only hope, and this by itself is a travesty of justice, is that the ship owners will make the government understand how big a mistake it was for the Greek interest, under international law, and under any sense of morality, really. Not to mention that Iran was the only country which gave to Greece oil on credit up to 700 million euros when we were not able to pay a few years ago, due to the crisis. Mm-hmm. Also, Iran is a country that has historically stood by Cyprus' rights in the international organizations. So it's a very difficult situation. Even certain Greek laws were bypassed, I have to say, in stealing this oil. For example, it's not allowed to do so in the port of Karistos, where the transfer happened. And it was reported that the Coast Guard revolted against it. But the government did it anyway. Plus, our independent inspection body against money laundering has said that the Iranian tanker shall be left to continue its trip as all paperwork was fine. So I think that Iran has to go legally against Greece here. I don't see any, I mean, that was what the Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs said to Greece. Mm-hmm. You have to go the legal route. And we were the first ones, unfortunately, to do the piracy. Well, so we have to do it. Yes.
We did hear him as well. But when he said that, when he tried to condemn Greece for this act, he also said that it is very vital that we keep good intentions between both countries. And here I come about what you wrote in your article, because after this incident, what happened is that after this incident, Iran addresses not the Greek government, but it's addressing Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis' bosses. This is what they are saying. This is what the Iranian media even is referring to. That because a spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry told Blinken, the U.S. foreign minister, that Washington was the, and I quote, disruptor of free trade in the world, the main disruptor of free trade in the world. And that, and I quote again, that the time for the United States to decide on its own is over. If this issue is not resolved anytime soon, Lamprini, how do you think Iran's options will be to retain what it belongs to her?
Hopefully, because of the support, diplomatic solution will be found, given the confiscation of the two Greek tankers also, because it's 1-2, and those two are of very powerful people. This counter-confiscation was the message that such actions have consequences, a fact that the Greek government was apparently oblivious to. Hopefully the tanker will be returned to Iran and the two Greek tankers will be sent back in exchange. And hopefully the wonderful way that the Iranians are treating the sailors, the people working on those ships, will be an example for us here too, because it's the same for the people that were on the Iranian tanker here.
And the public, one last thing in 30 seconds, the public sentiment towards what's going on between Iran and Greece, what are the people in Athens saying?
People in Athens believe that we did something very bad. The moral part is what they see, and they're against the government for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the general feeling that you have. Everybody says that. It was the first time that even trolls didn't talk against us when we wrote about what happened.
Well, it seems that if the people are actually on the good side of this, then most definitely this will end in a good way, hopefully, for both countries. I want to thank you very much, Lamprini Thoma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thanks a million for being our guest on this segment. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Erdogan's dream to annex more Syrian land.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
More than a week after Ankara launched a media and political campaign in search of a deal that would allow it to annex more Syrian land under the pretext of fighting Kurdish forces, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan lowered the expectations that had risen dramatically to talk about two small enclaves in the countryside of northern Aleppo that fall under the supervision of Russia. Thus, Erdogan throws the ball into Moscow's court in the context of the negotiating game he is playing to exploit the war in Ukraine, while the Syrian Kurdish separatists SDF appear to be facing a new difficult test as all eyes turn towards how this deal will be played out. Erdogan seeks more land occupation in Syria in this following report.
After a phone call between the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the Russian President Vladimir Putin, during which the two sides discussed many files related to the war in Ukraine, the food crisis facing the world, in addition to the situation in northern Syria, Erdogan announced in a speech to the deputies of the Justice and Development Party in Parliament that the target of the next phase of Turkish military operations in Syria is Membij and Tel Rifat in the countryside of Aleppo. The new Turkish statements, which significantly lowered expectations, came after a round of diplomatic negotiations between Turkey, the United States, and countries in the European Union as part of the ongoing Western efforts to double the pressure on Russia by including Sweden and Finland in NATO. While Washington provided Ankara during those negotiations with great facilities, including working to revive the F-16 deal that it had suspended when it took a firm stance towards a new Turkish military operation in Syrian areas inhabited by Kurdish separatists. In the face of the course of events, the Turkish president's choice of the Membij and Tel Rifat areas in particular appears to bypass Ankara's failure to obtain American facilities, knowing that the two areas have been the subject of controversy since the SDF took control of them in 2016 with Russian air cover. The subsequent Russian-Turkish agreements, during which Ankara pledged to take effective steps in Idlib, northwest Syria, by isolating what it refers as Kurdish terrorists and working to open the Aleppo-Latakia road, while Moscow pledged to monitor the activity of the Kurds and ensure that they do not take Manbij and Tel Rifat as a launching pad for any attacks. During the past 2 years, in parallel with Washington's withdrawal from certain areas in Syria and the concentration of its occupation forces in the oil areas, the Turkish president tried to pressure again to control Manbij and Tel Rifat. The SDF relies heavily on Manbij to carry out large commercial transactions related to oil smuggling operations to and from the north and northwest of Syria, in addition to the smuggling of Turkish goods. Despite Russia's toughness on the ground, Moscow's political position seemed softer than that of its American counterpart regarding the Turkish desire to annex areas inside Syria, which appears to be related to the agreement signed between the two parties, in which Russia has expressed more than once its concern about Turkey's delay in implementing its pledges in Idlib. This brings the overall Russian-Turkish understandings to the fore once again and puts the SDF before a difficult test in the area of Tel Rifat and Manbij, where it will find itself again demanding to hand over the two areas to the Syrian army, which would cut off Turkey's road to them and enable Russia to implement its pledges to protect them. However, this step is still closely related to the Idlib file, in which any tangible progress will lead to similar progress in Manbij and Tel Rifat. Faced with this equation and considering the absence of the American presence in the last two regions and the increase in Turkish pressure, the Kurds who seek American support and whose relationship with Russia is experiencing a chill due to falling into the arms of Washington are in a seriously difficult position.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Berlin is founder of Syriana Analysis YouTube channel and news website, Kevork Almasyan. Thank you very much, my good friend, for being with us today to discuss this issue, because weeks of propaganda and media frenzy, if I may, in Turkey concerning the so-called safe zone in Syria. And yet now we see Erdogan seeking new negotiations with Russia concerning just a couple of towns, but there are Syrian towns in the northern part of Aleppo, Manbij and Tel Rifat. But what changed Erdogan's mind right now?
Thank you very much, Mauro, for having me. This is a very old Turkish plan in Syria. Apparently, since the eruption of the CIA regime change war on Syria, Turkey had eyes on Aleppo and Mosul. And we remember how the ISIS, al-Nusra, and other terror groups expanded in these areas and also expanded the Turkish influence over these regions. But after 2015 and 2016, when ISIS was defeated, thanks to the Syrian army, the Russian forces, Iranians, and the Lebanese forces in the region, Turkey has changed its plan, especially in the northern part of Syria, that they want to create the so-called safe zones. And these safe zones are basically areas of influence for Turkey. And they want to create these areas for multiple reasons. One, they want to send back the Syrian refugees. I think there are around 4 million Syrian refugees in Turkey to this area. So therefore, they have to change the demographics of this area, kick out the people who lived there for centuries, and they resettle the type of people Erdogan wants to send them in these areas, and those who are more loyal to Erdogan. And these areas are subjected to Turkification because they are Turkish schools, and people are who are born there, they go to Turkish schools, learn Turkish language, deal with Turkish currency. Therefore, they would be Turkified. And this has happened under the Ottoman Empire as well a few centuries ago, right? And now Erdogan wants to create this belt to resettle the refugees, and two, to Turkify it, and three, he will call in the future a referendum, and he will say these people want to join the Turkish Turkey. And this is his plan. Therefore, Russia has now intervened, and they are negotiating with the Turkish side. However, the Russian side position is not really strong when it comes to Erdogan, because Russia also needs Turkish neutrality, quote-unquote, when it comes to Ukraine, because Erdogan can inflict more damage to Russia right now than he used to be previously in the Ukrainian case if he, for example, blocks the phosphorus in front of the Russian
or
Navy,
if he allows Sweden and Finland to enter to NATO,
exactly,
which means
exactly.
He has now cards in his hands to play and negotiate with Russia. But he told reporters last week, I'm saying Erdogan told reporters, we will launch a campaign against them and we must do it. Is he referring to the Kurdish natives, Syrian nationals living in the areas that he wants to annex? Or is he also seeking some sort of an open engagement with the Syrian Arab army as well?
Marwa, I believe the Kurdish militia presence is just an excuse for Erdogan to intervene. Even before the Kurdish presence there, there was no Kurdish presence in Aleppo. There was no Kurdish presence in Idlib, but there are Turkish forces in these areas, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just an excuse. Unfortunately, Syria, the Syrian army will not engage directly with Turkey in this regard because Turkey is a NATO member. And they will activate, I think, Article 6 of the NATO Charter in order to call for the United States and other superpowers to intervene on the side of Turkey, right? So it's a very complicated situation. I think Turkey will not target Syrian army positions directly. Maybe in certain positions, posts, yes, but it will not be, a big war between both sides. Russia will be in the middle, will try to minimize the damages for Syria. Unfortunately, Syria's leverage is not that big in this file, and Russia is preoccupied with the Ukrainian war. Therefore, Syria's position is not really strong. So we have to take this into consideration when it comes to geopolitical conflicts in the region. And we have to wait also for the Ukrainian war. Syria is also waiting for the outcome of the Ukraine war when Russia comes out as victorious, as Damascus hopes for. And after that, the position of Russia will be stronger when it comes to the eastern shores of the Euphrates against the Americans and also with Turkey, because Turkey will not have the same cards to blackmail, Russia when the war is over.
So what you're saying, Gabor, is this is a particularly favorable geopolitical moment for Erdogan here, because Russia is preoccupied with the war in Ukraine, and with Russia being a major player inside of Syria, it is focusing its attention and its resources towards what's going on in neighboring Ukraine. But how realistic is this approach towards a possible escalation inside Syria? Because also Erdogan does not really have that much of a power inside of his own nation anymore, coming up with the elections next year. So he is also in a conundrum. He doesn't want a war, but on the same side, he doesn't want to lose any land inside of Syria. So where is that putting him?
Erdogan, despite all our reservations about him, he is very clever and he is a very good chess player, and he's a merchant. He's doing his bazaar in the past at least 10 years in Syria, especially when it comes to areas that were occupied by the terrorists. So he's exchanging certain geographics, like I take this part, I give you that part. And this is a very, a dangerous game for Turkey as well, because in my opinion, if Turkey succeeds or Erdogan succeeds in his plan, he will be reelected. And the so-called neo-Ottomanism will continue in the region, and therefore we will have more troubles in the region. But he may also fall in the next elections if he doesn't succeed completely in Syria, because the economic situation is very dire in Turkey, and there is a very huge pressure on the Turkish people by the influx of the refugees. Of course, there are millions of refugees that could add pressure on the economy, but there is a big propaganda by the Turkish side to against the refugees. They want to kick them out from Syria, from Turkey. They are spreading negative sentiments towards them, racism, and we can see lots of assaults against Syrian refugees in Turkey, and this is all state-sponsored and state media-sponsored attacks because of the racism that they embraced in the past few months. And therefore, Erdogan desperately wants regions in Syria that are not controlled by the Syrian government to send hundreds of thousands of refugees, or to start sending them against their will to these areas, and later to capture these areas.
Well, that would seem like, I don't know, some sort of a complicated plan, because they all might actually turn against him if they don't like what's going on and they don't like that plan. But That's the time that we have, Kevork. It's always a pleasure having you on board the Middle East Stream. Kevork Almasyan from Berlin, founder of Syriana Analysis YouTube channel and news website. Thanks a million for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week because we have much more interesting things again next week on the Middle East Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The end of the fake regime of Israel is writ large on the wall, says Ayman Ahmad, journalist, in an article published under the heading Zionist Israel's Impending Doom. Here's the details. Like all oppressors, the Zionist entity displays two contradictory traits: extreme cruelty towards the Palestinians under occupation and fear of resistance. This has led some Israeli regime officials to express deep concern about its survival. Take Ehud Barak. He's no pacifist or alarmist since he had served as both the regime's army chief and as prime minister. He has said that the Zionist entity may not live to see its 80th birthday. The 80th year curse, as it is called, is part of Jewish history. No Jewish regime has lasted longer than 80 years. There is no reason to believe its present iteration would live past this time frame. There are good reasons for this grim prognosis. There are both internal and external reasons for this. The vast majority of Israeli citizens do not believe it would last long. This explains their obsession with getting a second passport, mostly of some European country. Clearly, they do not believe an Israeli passport provides enough security. When Tel Aviv airport was opened for international flights soon after the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza ended in May 2021, some 50,000 Israeli citizens fled occupied Palestine. In addition to their historical fear, and it may well come to pass, there are also more pressing immediate concerns. One is the Palestinians' refusal to be cowed down despite the Zionist extreme brutality and its brazen support by Western regimes. The latest example of this was witnessed in the executioner-style killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghla on May 11th. She was shot and killed by an Israeli regime sniper outside Jenin refugee camp, despite wearing a jacket clearly marked in bold letters as press. Western regimes, led by the US and joined by others like Canada, Britain, and a host of Europeans, merely called for an investigation into the death of Abu Aghla. They could not even bring themselves to admit that she was murdered. By saying she died, it gave the impression as if this was something natural. The New York Times put a similar misleading headline on May 12th about her execution-style killing. It said, Shirin Abu Aqileh, trailblazing Palestinian journalist, dies at 51. Compare this to its headline of March 13th regarding Brent Reno. Brent Reno, an American journalist, is killed in Ukraine. Shirin Abu Aqileh was also an American citizen, but such information was largely missing from media or even official U.S. reports. Why the contrasting descriptions? Further, the Times merely re-argued Israeli propaganda that there was firing between Palestinian gunmen and Israeli regime forces. This has since been debunked by eyewitnesses as well as CNN. Reno died when the car was traveling, came under fire at a checkpoint in Ukraine. Abu Aqileh was specifically targeted by an Israeli regime sniper. He knew precisely that he was targeting. The bullet was fired using a U.S.-supplied M16 rifle with a telescopic sight that fired at the small opening between Abu Aqileh's steel helmet and her bulletproof collar. It was a targeted killing. Under Nitzan pressure, the NYT corrected its headline, but its pro-Israel bias was clearly evident. Let us, however, return to the issue of fears about the Zionist regime's survivability. Several factors can be cited. While indulging in extreme cruelty against the Palestinians, targeted killings, home demolitions, night raids on Palestinian homes to arrest people, and imprisoning thousands of Palestinians, including women and children, it has successfully peddled a narrative of victimhood. The Western corporate media simply parrots this nonsensical lie. Western regimes led by the US, but now joined by Britain, France, Germany and Canada, among others, have also launched vicious campaigns criminalizing calls for boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS movement. In the Queen's speech in Parliament last month, the Boris Johnson regime declared it would ban local councils and other public bodies from participating in boycott and divestment campaigns. France has banned marches that criticize the Zionist regime's crimes and invasions. Similar restrictive policies have been implemented in Germany. Both in the US and Canada, similar campaigns have been launched to stifle criticism of the Zionist regime's crimes. For instance, 27 states in the U.S. have forbidden campaigns and educational institutions from joining the BDS campaign. In Canada, both the federal government and the Ontario provincial government have signed onto the International Remembrance Alliance definition that equates criticism of the Israeli regime with anti-Semitism. It has faced pushback from academic institutions as well as from many fair-minded Jewish groups. Why are these regimes so desperate to ram down the throats of their citizens' policies that clearly violate the fundamental rights of the people? They are supporting an oppressive colonial settler entity in the West Asia region. Therein lies the crux of the matter. Despite being most ruthless military machine in the West Asia region and beyond, the Western regimes see in occupied Palestine their own past. Canada and the U.S. are colonial settler entities. The European settlers perpetrated genocides against indigenous peoples in North America. Most of them came from Britain, France, Spain, and Portugal. The Western regimes do not see anything wrong with the fake regime of Israel indulging in similar genocide of the Palestinian people. In fact, they applaud such despicable conduct because it validates their own past behavior. The challenge that Zionist Israel faces today is that it is virtually impossible for it to wipe out the Palestinians as was done by the European settlers many centuries earlier. The socio-political and information environments are very different today. The alternative media continues to expose the ugly face of Zionism and its barbaric practices against the Palestinian people. Amnesty International has exposed the apartheid nature of Israel, as has the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights in its annual report into the human rights violations in Palestine and other occupied Palestinian territories. The UN report follows the publication of similar findings of Israeli apartheid by Human Rights Watch, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, and Israeli human rights organizations B'Tselem, Yesh Din, and many other international and regional human rights organizations. Not surprisingly, the Zionist regime clamped down on Palestinian human rights organizations for documenting its violations of human rights of the Palestinians and advocating for accountability by all duty bearers. In October 2021, the fake regime of Israel outlawed six Palestinian human rights organizations, accusing them of aiding and abetting terrorism. Concurrent with these, the resistance front is becoming increasingly sophisticated. Comprising Islamic Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Palestinian Islamic groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Syria, Ansarullah in Yemen, and resistance groups in Iraq have all become formidable opponents of the fake regime of Israel and the Zionist entity. It is, however, the solidarity of movements in Western countries and around the world, and the growth of BDS movements on campuses that frightens the Zionist regime so much. Similarly, its own population has no confidence in its long-term survival. The end of Israel is writ large on the wall.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Change is hard, especially when paired with dismemberment. That's what the Raisi economic reforms are being called, economic surgery, as he, the Iranian president, scraps the subsidized rate of the dollar, the 4200 currency, that is, and as he scraps subsidies on some goods.
But will subsidies actually be scrapped or just take a different form? Idea is they be replaced by cash handouts and the like, which have begun so that the most vulnerable can benefit. Because with subsidies on goods and services, the rich appear to benefit more than the poor. Question is, have the right goods been selected for desubsidizing, and was the timing right? Welcome to Iran Today with me, Leila Faramarzi. The economic reforms at large are not a new thought, but previous administrations eschewed them for their possible painful fallouts. By mid-May 2022, however, 72 million of Iran's 85 million people got texts saying 3 to 4 million rials had been deposited to their bank accounts. That would have been $10 to $14 as a first cash handout. Our guest tells why a U-turn from indirect subsidies to direct.
Mr. Rajoy I found to be an interesting breed of cleric as he was explaining at Press TV Studios how he did a PhD in economics in the UK. He tends to agree with the government's economic reforms, but hopes for greater transparency.
این روشی که ما داشتیم روشی بود که چون ما قیمت‌ها رو پایین نگه می‌داریم.
In our previous way of dispensing subsidies, all people used to receive cash handouts because we kept the consumer prices low. In this way, rich people would receive more subsidies from the government, which was unfair. Taking those with the highest income and those with the lowest income, we see that rich people would receive more cash handouts for those products to which subsidies had been allocated. For example, for the imported rice, which is considered a cheap consumer product, families with the highest income would receive 1.65% more subsidy than those with the lowest income. In comparison to people with the lowest income, families with the highest income would also receive 1.78% and 2.33% more respectively for subsidized cooking oil and chicken. When we allocate subsidies to cheap products like lamb, those who consume this product 31 times more would receive 31 times more subsidy than those who don't.
In case you're looking for some healthy criticism, Mr. Hatemi Yazdi, an economist, doesn't exactly see light at the end of the tunnel. He has suggestions for improvement, however, which he shared with us at his flat in a haven in leafy North Tehran.
Why the U-turn from indirect subsidies to direct?
It is true that hidden subsidies or undeclared subsidies need to be substituted by open, frank, and possibly cash subsidies. But any change in economic structure of a country need to be studied properly. Scientific analysis has to be carried out. It's not enough to say that we are going to change the undeclared subsidies into cash subsidy. A good objective may be badly executed. We have experienced over the last 50 years that every time the government tried to set prices at below market price, setting any price at below market price involves some sort of subsidies which should not be given. Such subsidies will not help economic growth, will not help investment, and while you sell anything at government stated price that is lower than market price, you discourage investment, you discourage production.
President Raisi himself has explained why his administration cut government subsidies for a number of basic goods and medicine. The government has, yes, been allocating billions of dollars in subsidies for basic goods and needs, such as flour, cooking oil, chicken, eggs and sugar, for long. And even now, in effect, the 13th government is not actually cutting government subsidies for these goods, but is changing the piecemeal subsidy system into a smart one by, say, giving out monthly food vouchers for basic goods at subsidized rates. Apart from returning to the system of direct subsidies, which can reduce the possibility of smuggling, having eliminated currency 4200, the government appears determined to take or further the following measures to reform the economy. Those would be increasing and expanding taxation, controlling exchange rates, and boosting production by funneling liquidity into production. It's all easier said than done, however, listening to our economist. Let's begin with the matter of scrapping subsidized exchange rates to controlling free market rates by government decree. The present rate is around and over 30,000 tumans, or 300,000 rials to the dollar.
Why did the exchange rate 4,200 tumans to the dollar have to be scrapped, or 42,000 rials to the dollar?
ببینید از 4200 چند اشکال داشت.
our 42,000 rial currency rate had some problems. First, rich people would receive more subsidies. Second, it was easy for smugglers to traffic products that were manufactured at cheap prices. Third, when the government's preferential currency rate is exchanged 7 to 8 times higher in the free market, profiteers try to get more preferential currency than they need and sell their products at way higher prices. The preferential currency rate had also another problem. The low price of imported oilseeds like barley and wheat, which are used as food for both people and livestock, left no incentive for domestic producers to produce soybeans, corn or wheat as they were not profitable for them any longer.
Currency 4200, or the subsidized rate of the rial to the dollar, that's 42,000 rials to the dollar, was in theory meant for importers. This way they could buy foreign food and medicine and materials at a lower price to bring in.
However, it, the subsidized rate that is, was cause for misuse and black market sales. It aided and abetted a multi-layered currency market with 3-4 rates to the dollar, and it was not easy to use practically. The last is because it took time for importers to receive their 42,000 rials or 4,200 chumans to the dollar. And so they in turn took their time in paying their foreign trade partners for goods. So the goods were just lying about in docks, causing further cargo fees. Our guest tells why currency 4,200 had to be scrapped.
Mr. Qaderi is an MP on the Parliamentary Economic Committee. We got to connect with him on Skype.
The preferential 42,000 rial currency rate was a root cause of corruption in the country because everyone was trying to get that. When the difference between the government's preferential currency rate and open market currency rate is way too much, economic rent or corruption are expected to happen. The country's needs will also be exaggerated, and as a result, more preferential currency would be allocated for those needs. For example, we used to import oilseeds, livestock inputs, and pharmaceutical raw materials in huge quantities to the country. But after we remove the preferential currency rate, we'll see a significant reduction in those imports.
The government may not even get currency from the central bank and buy the 242,000 rial currency itself. Now, when the government gives individuals preferential 42,000 rial currency while buying it at 240,000 rial, how can it offset the difference? The government has no other option to offset the difference but to borrow from the central bank. If the government does so, the monetary base will increase, and because the money multiplier in our country is 8 for every rial the government borrows from the central bank, money creation is increased by 8 times over a period of time, and the 42,000 rial currency rate, which was meant to lower prices, will conversely increase prices through increasing the country's monetary base.
As for controlling free market exchange rates, economists are generally at a loss as to how that can even work, as markets are a living organism in which rates work themselves out.
Prices themselves act as an indicator. When you remove the 42,000 real currency and reach the products to a real prices, you can use this removal for other purposes. Removing the 42,000 real currency rate can cause inflation. But if we still continue with our previous monetary policies and keep the 42,000 real currency rate, more and more inflation will happen in the country. People may be surprised first when they see the 42,000 real currency allocated to their consumer products has been removed, but this is just temporary. People may also relate the increased prices of other products to the removal of the 42,000 rial currency, while this is not the case. The base salary of civil servants and non-civil servants has increased respectively by 60 and 57%. The price of utilities has also increased. These all give rise to an increase in the other consumer products as well, and this increase is not related to the 42,000 rial currency rate removal.
Then there's further taxation for reforms, for justice. But will it bear justice? It's not easy to get it right with taxation in that, say, having a big old house doesn't mean handy cash to give away as tax. Or embezzlers and tax evaders being slippery eels are not easy to pin down. Raisi, as early as December 2021, did outline a budget funded by higher taxes on the wealthy and a modest rise in crude sales. At the time, the government expected tax receipts to rise by 62% due to a projected 8% GDP growth and higher taxes on imports and new levies on those who own expensive houses and cars, as pointed to by FT, the Financial Tribune.
There are people in the country who have high levels of earnings that are not registered anywhere. These are the people who work as merchants or middlemen. To help tackle this, we need to have clarifications in the accounts and transactions. If the government is the entity that manages the country and wants to remove poverty and develop economic plans, it needs to have comprehensive information about its people, and this is what is performed in developed countries. It's the irresponsibility of a government when it does not deal with the people's accounts and transactions.
The tax rates in Iran has many problems. Although, generally speaking, the amount of tax the government takes in relation to the general GDP or total income of the country is very low compared with Europe, compared with even Asian countries. We only receive about, the government receives about 7% of GDP in the form of tax. But the taxing structure in Iran involves a lot of corruption. Because the individual sitting in the Ministry of Finance who wants to tax a company, he's susceptible to receiving bribes in reducing the tax or creating problem for them by increasing unduly the tax that the taxpayer must pay.
More cash for production is the next step toward economic reform in an economy bearing the weight of a 50% inflation, caused mainly by minting unbacked money for loan renting and the likes. Production and a resistance economy when U.S. sanctions are looming and JCPOA revival talks are at a standstill has been a solution also on the former administration's agenda. Question is, will the Raisi administration get to deliver on funding actual businessmen who will invest their loans in industry rather than pocket it and run off, leaving the government behind with factory worker demonstrations to deal with?
The current administration, together with the parliament, passed a law on the facilitation of obtaining business licenses, which eliminates the bureaucracy obstacles in the way of small to medium-sized manufacturing units and reduces the cost and time of obtaining permits to run a business. This helps the growth of production in Iran. On the other hand, we're working on the capital gains tax law in the parliament, which prevents the liquidity from going into non-productive and brokerage sections of the society. These are some of the measures by the current administration which helps the growth of production.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Currency 4200, or the subsidized rate of the dollar, was a major platform for corruption. But the list of items eligible for cheaper foreign exchange had already been gradually scaled down since 2018. Now, in the next few months, the government plans to introduce electronic coupons to only pay a subsidy once a transaction takes place. The system will be based on a mobile phone app. Through this, consumers will only pay a share of the price for basic food staples. Those are basically bread, chicken, eggs, cooking oil, and milk. The mobile phone app would rationalize consumption and hinder smuggling of subsidized goods from Iran to neighboring countries. Even reforms can entail new forms of misuse. Say, while subsidy reforms are designed to eliminate rent-seeking or rentierism, the hasty increase of food prices has generated massive grounds for rent and rentiering by importers and traders that had hoarded large quantities of basic foods before. Also, there are still blanket subsidies in place for some food categories, which also opens up space for rent-seeking.
Inflation is the root cause of all the troubles that we've been suffering in this country for the last 50 years. Inflation is the root cause of any corruption that is economic corruption that is occurring in this country. Inflation is creating or widening the gap between the rich and poor. What the government is missing, what government economic policy is missing now, is the anti-inflationary policy. Even since the new subsidy policy is adopted, the price of dollar has been increased at least 10%. Do we have to increase the subsidy again by 10%? The subsidy that Ahmadinejad paid to the people was almost equal to $40 a month. The subsidy that this government is offering is less than one-third of that.
Now, it's not just currency rate setting, but price setting for food, goods, and commodities that the government has taken upon itself. And this continued price setting and interference in the market has generated a new scope for corruption. Moreover, the Raisi administration insists on exclusively controlling the importing of basic goods, as well as the apparent push to dominate issuing trade licenses. This foresees an unwarranted future of new economic rents in the system of governance.
To set a price for chicken or bread or energy by the government is not the correct move. Even if you give them the subsidy, when you're calculating the subsidy, you have to refer to the rate of exchange. Okay, when you change the rate of exchange, you're changing the subsidy again. I give you an example. When we set the price of petrol at 3,000 tuman, it was almost equal to $1. That wasn't a subsidized price. But when you set the exchange rate at 30,000, 10 times that price, you are subsidizing 10 times.
Critics have a problem with timing and or type of reforms. Reformist former Vice President Mohammad Reza Aref believes a more appropriate starting point would have been the lifting of energy subsidies. Or economics professor Morteza Afrah believes that reforms have been wrongly timed. Because, he says, in the absence of Iran being removed from the blacklist of FATF, that's the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, the cost of implementing the reforms will rise, and this will put more pressure on ordinary people. Also, Parliamentary Speaker Ghalibaf has criticized the Raisi administration for hiking wheat prices before introducing electronic coupons, which he says have been mandated by the budget law. That's given the distress among people over increased food prices. Ghalibaf also claims that Iran's budget law for the current Iranian calendar year, which began on March the 21st, mandates that the government use smart coupons to offer staples at September 2021 rates. Raisi does have all that on his agenda, but he's begun with redistributing subsidies and following guidelines set by Parliament in the budget law. How importers went about the now-scrapped currency rate 4200 was that they would apply to the CBI, Central Bank of Iran, for foreign exchange allocations to, say, import wheat at lower prices. But what the government was doing by this intervention was that it was making foreign money cheaper, but not lowering the actual bread prices. The central bank partially did get to stabilize exchange rates by introducing NEMA. That's a centralized foreign exchange market for importers and exporters. Anyhow, whatever the exchange rate, a valid argument is that in diverting precious foreign exchange resources, the government bearing inflation in mind should be directing these resources towards importers of intermediate goods, goods on which made in Iran products depend. This could boost production, obviously. But to make up for exchange rate subsidies failing, the CBI finally decided to keep the exchange rate in place, but to eliminate the range of imports eligible for the rate. To top all measures, the Raisi administration began its economic surgery regardless of pain, protest or results of the Vienna sanction lifting talks. And it is to soften the blow of the reform that Raisi will be providing the targeted cash transfers for 2 months to the most vulnerable, having put electronic coupons on the menu as well.
Our current government has not limited its trades and economic ties to Western countries and is using the Eastern and neighboring countries' capacities while keeping its ties with the West.